One quick note before this episode begins. There is a slight echo on Tiffany's voice at the beginning of the episode, but please do not click out. It goes away in about a minute.
Hello, Bird Feed, and welcome to this week's mini legal episode here at Current Affairs. I'm Vanessa AB, your social media editor, and I'm joined by Oren Nimni, your legal editor.
Hello, everyone.
And today we have with us newly DSA endorsed candidate for Queens DA, Tiffany Caban. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, y'all. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Good.
It's really, really good to have you with us. We have lots of questions for you. We're fresh off our live show where we talked about prosecutors at length. And so I'm really stoked that our first mini legal episode back is with a progressive, a leftist running for prosecutor in Queens. So I was hoping you could start us off by introducing yourself to everyone, telling us what pushed you to run, and just giving us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I have been a public defender in New York City for the past 7 years. We've gotten to a place where the system is obviously broken. You see all of these amazing things that are happening around the country in terms of these progressive, reform-minded, decarceral DAs and just the possibilities that that's opened up. The other thing that's happening locally is that Queens especially is a place where our communities are getting politically activated in a way that they haven't been in years. And that's been super exciting. As a public defender, I spend all day, every day talking about my clients and the system and all the ways in which it's broken. So it's been so refreshing and so invigorating to have our communities talking about those things as well. For me, my decision to run very much so feels like the natural progression in my advocacy for my clients. You know, the DA's office is a place where we can institute some much needed radical reform that could not only benefit folks from the criminal justice system perspective, but also housing, healthcare, education, because they're also deeply intertwined. I went into public defense work because I honestly come from the communities that are affected by the criminal justice system. And so for me, it was almost this opportunity to have reparative experiences and help other folks who haven't had the same access to the privileges I have, like access to higher education, access to therapy spaces. That's a large part of the reason why I'm running.
I wanted to dive into a little bit of some of the specific things in your platform and just hear a little bit more broadly and deeper on some of your priorities. It's a pretty broad base of things that you want to tackle, stuff from removing civil asset forfeiture to decriminalizing sex work. And I was wondering how you determined what the priorities were going to be for you if you were to be elected DA, how you determined like decriminalizing sex work, civil asset forfeiture, war on drugs, like those are the things that I want to tackle first.
You know, for me, it comes from just my experiences on the front lines in court, mm-hmm. seeing what my clients go through, listening to them and hearing about the things that they care about most, then taking those conversations with the community at large throughout this process. So these are the things that folks in the community have indicated are the most important to them. And specifically when it comes to each issue, it's about talking to and listening to the folks that are most directly impacted. So where my policy comes from in terms of decriminalizing and destigmatizing sex work, well, that comes from listening to folks in the sex work community. And that's pretty much the way we've approached it from across the board.
I know, particularly in New York, folks at Streetwise and Safe and other folks have really done a lot of campaigns around the way that policing of sex work works. And then also things like, you know, like carrying a condom being evidence of that you're going to participate in sex work. And so it seems like it's a really good first target area.
Yes. And one of the really important things about this is this idea that by decriminalizing and destigmatizing sex work, what you're doing is you're creating an environment where we can actually target sex trafficking because they're mm-hmm. two entirely different things. And it's also a way to, again, limit the harm that's been done in the past. And, you know, one of the things that I'm certainly very in tune with because it is my community, is the fact that queer folks, especially trans people of color, are disproportionately impacted by criminalization of sex work. And sex work is work. And beyond that, we have to be taking into account all of the sort of structural and systemic environment that comes into play. The fact that that particular community does find themselves being more prevalent in that work because of discriminations that are taking place in housing and mm-hmm. employment spaces. And all those are all things that we need to be considering as well.
Yeah, something that has always struck me about a very carceral approach to sex work is that there's this acknowledgement, you know, from liberals and from conservatives that it's a very, that it can be very dangerous work. But at the same time, the constant threat of prosecution makes it so that if people do feel unsafe, it's really unclear that they could turn to the government for help, that they could, you know, report having been assaulted. And even that, I think, really blurs the lines between, you know, this idea that I don't even really know how to phrase it, but I think people often conflate sex work with the idea that that means that sex workers cannot be assaulted or raped. You know, because you sell sex, you then also are not entitled to not consenting, you know, to some aspects of sex. And I think that, like, decriminalizing it obviously would go a long way towards making that community much safer.
Yes, specifically when you criminalize sex work, again, you create an environment where if someone is harmed or is the survivor or victim of a crime, you're leaving them in a position where they can't seek both medical help and help from the police department and our DA's offices.
I wanted to flip to the other side. So a lot of your policy proposals are things that you would, areas where you would limit prosecution or areas where you would seek to sort of effectively decriminalize particular activities. And I wanted to flip to the other side because there is a part of your platform that talks about, I think you frame it as like tackling the 6% of offenders that commit 60% of the crime. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about what you mean by that, like who you're talking about, how that sort of targeting would work, and how that meshes with this sort of vision of like making things decarcerated.
Sure. So this idea of the 6% of people that commit 60% of the crime, it's actually this sort of universal truth, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the 6% of folks who are assaulting, for example, making up 60% of the assaults that are being done, the 6% of overprescribers of opioids being responsible for 60% of that practice. And so what we're talking about is, you know, understanding that the role of the office is to prosecute, but really redefining what it means to prosecute, because up to this point, it has been about punishment for punishment's sake and not about two questions we should be focusing on. How do we make sure this thing doesn't happen again? And how do we make our communities safer in actuality? And doing that really means being mindful around and putting in the effort to understand what the root causers of the behavior are, and providing treatment, access, support around those things to drive down recidivism and actually stop the behavior.
And how do you do that as a DA? I mean, are you constrained from being able to recommend those services? I'm not a prosecutor and I'm not a public defender, so I have a sense of what DAs do and some of the bad things they can do. There aren't very many good examples, but to take a more holistic approach to figuring out what the root of the violence might be or to the misconduct, how do you do that as a DA? How do you take feedback from the community, and how do you connect the people that you would otherwise be prosecuting to these much needed services that you've mentioned?
It's about prioritizing where you expend your staff, your resources, and your money. Rather than having an office full of a million DAs, you make sure that you are staffing support workers that are trauma-informed, that do provide services. The beauty of the DA's power is that there is just so much discretion in how you decide to do justice, so to speak. So for example, there are a lot of programs within the DA's office that are created internally that have the purpose of providing services. There are portions of the budget that are expended in that direction. The issue I have with how that's being done right now is sort of the same issue I have with how the office is staffed in general. Mm-hmm. People are brought in from all over the place that don't necessarily have ties to the communities that they're supposed to be serving, don't understand what it is that those communities have been experiencing and historically have experienced. And so what we could and should be doing is really creating partnerships with community organizations that already exist, that are staffed by people from the community, have been doing the work for a long time, know their communities better than anybody else, and are starving for the resources and support to do the good work that they're trying to do. I can't tell you how many times as a public defender, I have made connections with the help of our social work staff with community organizations. Mm-hmm. And I suggest that as a resolution to a case. And I get the answer of, I've never heard of them. What do they do? And so that in itself causes an undue delay in terms of resolving cases and moving things along more quickly. But then the other thing I'll hear is, and I don't know if I could ever get my supervisor to sign off on that, mm-hmm. which again, does not make any sense. And so if we're coming from a place where we're already partnering with these community organizations, we'll move things along more quickly and we'll have better results.
Do you want to maybe talk about the part of your platform that pertains to community engagement? I think that's something that ties nicely into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, we want to make sure that we're making community engagement core to everything that mm-hmm. we do. And it's the idea that, again, the people that are most directly impacted by our criminal justice system and by the policies that we're implementing should be the ones that are driving the conversation and talking about what kinds of impacts they want to see in their community. So one of the things that's really important, well, several of the things that are really important to me is again, changing the makeup of the office a little bit and making it so that we have assistant district attorneys that are assigned to communities that have to be out in their communities, getting to know the people there and building better relationships. But beyond that, having regular town halls where we're meeting people where they're at, making it accessible. So providing Metro cards, providing meals, providing childcare, really making it a place where our communities not just feel like they're being heard, but know that they are in actuality being heard and that their feedback is being taken to heart and implemented.
I really like that because I feel like the way that I've heard, there's a sort of model of lawyering called community lawyering that I think exists in the world that is not usually used in district attorney's offices. And the times that I've heard community engagement engaged with on the sort of prosecutor or even court system side level, it's something like, you know, like the best examples are still not great. They're things like the Red Hook Community Court, where it's like, it's better than a regular criminal court. Like folks are out in the community, sort of everyone, you know, knows each other. Usually there's a little bit more pretrial diversion, you know, punishments are not as intense. But I remember talking to defendants in that court and being like, well, how do you like this court in comparison to other courts? And they were like, sometimes the sentences I get are more lenient, so I like that. And sometimes I get pretrial probation more often rather than being incarcerated, so I like that. But also like the court officer knows everyone in my housing project, and so if I like accidentally like slip up and like, you know, get high or something, like everyone's gonna know and I'm gonna be back in court. And so they were like, I don't know what I would prefer, like a really disconnected court system where I can like sometimes live my life but they punish me more, or a more connected court system where they don't punish me as much. And I feel like you're describing like a third option, which is like actually sort of being directed by the people that are most impacted by the criminal legal system, and not just as a vehicle to discover whether they're doing something, you know, that should be punishable, but actually to figure out how to reform the system itself.
And honestly, part of that process to make it successful is making a real concerted, genuine effort to repair the fractured trust between the DA's office and our communities as well. It's the only way it'll work. Mm-hmm. And you do that by charging with restraint, charging with discretion, showing that you are going to protect communities from harm that's, you know, being done on a larger scale, and not continuing to criminalize the things that the DA's office in our system historically has, you know, crimes born of poverty, of mental health and substance abuse.
And speaking of your different approach, I want to jump onto the part of your platform where you talk about taking on corporate crime. You know, I was looking at your platform and I was like, wow, these are some unusual targets, I think, compared to more mainstream candidates. And so could you tell us a little more about what your priorities are in that area and what your approach would look like in practice, starting with who your targets would be?
Sure. So among those targets are bad landlords, bad employers, doctors who are overprescribing opioids, for example. And again, it's about reallocating resources and changing. Also, I think part of the conversation, I know I jump around a little bit, but there are so many, it's so layered, it's so nuanced. Unfortunately, the metrics of success in the DA's offices around the country are convictions and sentences. What does that do? That drives the office towards prosecuting low-hanging fruit rather than getting at the real causers of crime and harm. I had a client who stole a cell phone from somebody. He was addicted to opioids after having an accident, and the doctor started overprescribing and then was overprescribing for not just him and his friends. So in part of our advocacy for our client, we got a good deal of information about this doctor who was really doing a lot of harm to his community. We went to the DA and said, hey, you know, my client wants some drug treatment support, and here's this information that he could offer you so that we can go after this person that's really hurting a lot of people. And to make a long story short, that case unfortunately resolved with my client serving some jail time and them not following up at all on that lead. And that's what we need to be having the switch on. In the case of employers dealing with wage theft and misclassifying workers and unsafe practices, I've had clients who are charged with stealing, put that in air quotes, small amounts of money in their employers. And when you dig deeper, you find out that the employer has been stealing their wages, that the employer has not been giving them the paid leave that they are owed and deserved, and engaging in a whole host of other, not just abusive, but illegal practices. And so why are we prosecuting this employee when really the source of the problem is the employer in that situation? And the same goes for landlords. That's really the approach there.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your approach to misdemeanor prosecutions. So it seems like over the past while, but particularly the past 10, 15 years, there's been a rise in misdemeanor arrests and sort of initiations of prosecutions, but actually a reduction in convictions. And what it seems like is like people are getting into the system on these low level misdemeanors, and then they're getting pretrial probation, or they're getting, some sort of GPS monitoring or something, and they're just kind of staying perpetually in the system. And so I think when we talk about progressive approaches to prosecution, a lot of it focuses on decarceration. But I wanted to ask you more about like how you're going to deal with limiting the initiation of those sort of misdemeanor prosecutions, and how also you're going to deal with like the incentives that are provided to police to engage in that kind of work. Because a lot of it is, a lot of it is in the prosecutor's hand, but also there is this like, police are still arresting people for very low level misdemeanors. And that does start the system in some sense.
It does. It's really frustrating because the DA is in a position to decline to prosecute, to divert, and do a whole host of other things, but there really isn't control over what arrests the police are making. Mm-hmm. The DA can stop the harm as early as they can, but I think one of the other powerful things about the position of the DA is that you're not just making and informing and implementing policy, but you're also somebody that has the function of being able to go to Albany and push for legislation and things like that. One of the things that we should be supporting, obviously, is the legalization of marijuana, because it has been very much so weaponized by the police department. It is one of the most frequently used reasons to stop somebody in areas that are traditionally over-policed. The odor of marijuana usually initiates a stop and a frisk, a search, and many times an arrest. And we take that away from the police department with legalization. So, certainly there's room for a DA to be pushing for legislative changes that could then have an effect on police practices.
Are you concerned at all about the power of the New York police unions? They've shown themselves, even, against de Blasio, who is mildest opponent, to be very resistant to any kind of change really in policing practices. And so how do you approach that relationship?
I expect pushback. I don't think that it's going to be an easy thing to navigate. And, for me, I also have recognition around the fact that police officers are people. And, my view is that just like the system of prosecuting is broken, our criminal justice system is broken, the system of policing is broken. I also understand in the communities that I grew up in, everybody always said you take every civil service exam that comes up because it is a way to have health care for your family. It is a way to make sure you have a good paycheck. You're going to be able to send your kids to school. You'll have a pension. You can retire with dignity. One of the things I think is the most powerful way to push back and oppose some of the resistance is this idea of full transparency and accountability, right? The police are going to push back, but we are very much so in a position to pull back the curtain and show our communities exactly what it is that we're doing, what practices are causing what results. And it really empowers our communities to collectively get together and say, hey, these are the changes we want to see. Because again, one of the exciting things about this moment in time we're in is that people are very much so aware when you're willing to give them the information, and will band together and really do what they have to do to drive change. And so it's not just our office that would be pushing back against the NYPD, but really we could create a situation where our entire borough is banding together to say, hey, these are the things we do want to see, and these are the things we don't want
to
see.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, you talked a little bit before about how the position of DA can engage both with the criminal elements of the criminal legal system, but also with all of the sort of other pieces, you know, healthcare, housing, all these other things. And I wanted to hear a little bit from you on what creative ways or what new ways you're thinking about how to deal with collateral consequences related to, you know, criminal prosecutions.
Collateral consequences, they exist across all kinds of categories, whether it be with your education, with your employment, with your immigration status, with your access to healthcare. And for me, it's about recognizing that when you are providing folks with stability and support and not disrupting access to any of those things, then we are creating an environment for our communities as a whole to be uplifted and to not just survive, but thrive, right? When it comes to prosecuting cases, we should always have collateral consequences at the forefront of our decision-making process. I represented a client on a turnstile jump not that long ago, despite the fact that Cy Vance had, you know, put out a press release saying that he wasn't prosecuting these things anymore. About a week later, I picked up this case and we fought it for a year and I went to trial on it. The point of my story here is that we have a situation where there really wasn't a consideration of collateral consequences. It was just, this guy has a record, he jumped the turnstile, he needs to be punished, he's the exception to the rule, he shouldn't get the benefit of this thing. We're talking about a person who was on parole, he had served prison time, had completed 3 of his 5 years of supervision. And in those 3 years, he completed a drug program. He was an escort for the program. So he was bringing other folks to their drug treatment court dates. Mm. He took him about 1.5 years to get some stable housing. He had this really great intimate partnership that was rooting him in his community. And she was an incredible source of support for him. He jumped the turnstile trying to get to his parole meeting. It was either that or risk being technically violated and ending up back in jail. When I asked the DA, hey, why aren't you making him an offer here, knowing that it is a mandatory minimum 6-month jail sentence on the parole violation. The parole officer even called the DA and said, hey, we don't want to violate him, but if he's found guilty of the misdemeanor, we have no choice. They could have offered him a violation, something that wouldn't land him back in jail. And I said, you don't make him this offer. What you're doing is you're taking away his housing, you're taking away his sobriety, you're taking away the relationship that roots him in his community. And then you throw him back out into our community and you're asking him to recidivize in some much more serious ways than, you know, hopping the turnstile and mm-hmm. the 275 from the city or whatever it was. That's what I'm talking about when we're talking about what are our goals and considering collateral consequences. When you disrupt people's lives in that way, you really set them up to struggle and then potentially harm.
I love that you took that turnstile case to trial.
So not only before it went to trial, because it was a year, I did a Clayton motion to dismiss in the interest of justice. We didn't mm-hmm. know what to do. And I even asked a beat reporter to sit in the front row of that trial just to be present, because the judges see them every day. They know mm-hmm. them. I mean, we made sure we left no stone unturned for this client.
It doesn't get a lot of play in sort of like criminal defense stuff, but I feel like there are a bunch of, you know, sort of legal adjacent tactics, like things like, you know, asking community members or asking reporters to be in the courtroom and watch judges, or things like, you know, Michelle Alexander had a really good article in the Times, like maybe in 2013, called Crash the System, Go to Trial, where she talked about, you know, the fact that most criminal cases plea out, and that actually, you know, if you're taking particularly low level charges to trial where you could win just sort of by the economy of the prosecutor's office not necessarily wanting to put in all of the time and effort that it takes to run a trial on something so small, that you could actually have a good success rate. So I really like that you did that.
It's this very scary thing, though. And again, coming from my experience as a defense attorney, because especially here in New York City, the decision to go to trial is one where you're going in blind in mm-hmm. literally in a lot of situations. And so asking, you know, your client taking that leap can be a very, very scary thing. I was working on a homicide case recently, and the case has been, it's still going on. The case has been going on for 2 years, and we still don't have all the evidence in the case. And the DA's, you know, telling my colleagues now that the rest of the evidence won't be handed over until after a jury is picked. Under the law, they can do that. But again, the DA's office is a place where you can say, hey, this is the law. It doesn't preclude us from giving over the evidence. And so let's set the tone for what best practices are. This is not about gamesmanship. This is not about wins. This is about fair play and justice. When we do go to trial on cases, invariably, to your point about the article, is like there are always these really powerful nuggets and things that we can argue and really have these strong defenses. But a lot of times there's ultimatums about taking deals now without having the evidence or you'll never see it again. And you know, all of these decisions that have to be made.
And let's talk about that. Let's talk about plea deals. What does it look like now, you know, for you on the other side of the Queen's DA as a public defender? And what do you hope it can look like when you're in office?
Again, by changing the metrics and saying, hey, DAs, you are not going to, your success is not going to be measured by your conviction rate, by your sentences, but by whether you are decarcerating our city, you are reducing recidivism, and you are applying the law equitably and fairly across racial and class lines, right? And those are the ways that you're going to advance in this office.
So really changing the incentives.
Exactly.
Measuring success differently.
Exactly. And so when those are the measures for success, in order to meet those goals, what you're going to have to do is immediately turn over evidence so that cases are moving along quickly, so that we're having more fair outcomes. You're going to prioritize and do your work around exploring alternatives to incarceration and trying to figure out what the root causers of certain behaviors are. Those are the changes that we'd be looking to make in the DA's office.
I wanted to ask you more like... To pull back from specific policies and ask a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a philosophical question or just a little bit of like a more removed question, just about your decision to run and coming from the PD's office and, you know, sort of having this mindset towards decarceration and wondering, like, do you feel like there are contradictions there? Do you feel like I've been against the DA's office for a while, but this is like maybe the best way to make impact? Or you're like, no, this is really good. Or, you know, like how are you thinking about it? Because I think it's a complex thing for people that are concerned about decarceration. And, you know, in the position as a district attorney, at some point you were likely going to be putting some people in jail. And now hopefully it'll be for less time. Hopefully it'll be part of a process that, you know, engages in kind of some restorative or transformative justice and does reduce recidivism and you know, targets particular things. But I'm just wondering, like, how you're thinking about it personally, like, you know, and, you know, are your friends giving you shit? Are you like...
God, my friends and my colleagues are so incredibly supportive. It took a lot of reconciling to come to this place, to commit to run. And it feels like something I need to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, before any of this, just to give you a sense of how I felt about it, anytime I was stopped in the courthouse hallways and somebody would be like, hey, are you the DA? And I'd be like, no, I'm one of the good guys. You know, like, I really meant that. I mean, I'd say it joking, but like in my heart, that's really what I believed. But I also believe that there are so many opportunities for the DA. You know, why is it that I thought that? And why isn't the DA the good guy in my mind? And there's so much opportunity for that to be the case. But it was a really hard decision to make, and I don't make it lightly. And I think that my background as a public defender makes it easy for folks to understand and buy into the fact that I am going to treat those accused of crimes fairly, humanely, compassionately. But at the same time, this is also about our communities as a whole. And it all really does tie together, because oftentimes those who harm are survivors of harm themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so again, that's where that trauma-informed practice comes in. And so this is about making our communities safer and understanding that the ways in which we have been sold this idea of public safety in the past, it's just such a fallacy and it doesn't work. And so there are so many things that we could be doing to take care of folks and decrease crime. And again, really make it so that people are able to be healthy and thrive. And then with that said, it allows us the opportunity to really focus on, again, people who are doing a lot of harm that we're not having success with alternatives to incarceration, and understanding that I don't take it lightly in the least. I certainly want to make sure we're exhausting every option before we say, hey, this is a person that potentially we need to figure something out for. Mm-hmm. And then let's start having the conversation around how our jails and our prisons are failing us. Mm-hmm. And why don't they look more like transitional housing models? Why aren't we paying folks a living wage when they're in the custody of our state? why aren't we making sure people are set up with benefits so that they can re-enter society with the things that they need? Why aren't we providing people with education, whether it is a college degree or vocational training, access to healthcare, making sure that people are set up to succeed when they do re-enter our communities? The beautiful thing about what I envision, what other folks are envisioning, is that this is such a small subset of the people that touch our criminal justice system. And we could be doing so much good for a large population of folks that find themselves tangled up in our system. Because unfortunately, ours is a system that takes what really are public health issues and punts them to our criminal mm-hmm. justice system. And this is our way of saying, hey, no, this isn't the place for that. Let's provide support and access to support in all of these other areas.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, historically, like, DA's offices have not been good for defendants, but also have not been good for victims or survivors of crime either, and have not represented them well, you know.
Not at all. And that's something that has to change too. I mean, I know I go back to my experience as a public defender a lot, but I can't tell you the number of times where I have had survivors or victims of crime reach out to me for help because they have felt like the DA's office has not helped them, mm-hmm. whether it be because they feel like they aren't being heard, that there's a paternalistic approach being taken. I see it a lot in intimate partner violence cases. We have a situation where the DA's office is supposed to be helping folks, but what they're really doing is recreating the same power and control dynamic that maybe that person is experiencing in their intimate partnerships. And so it's re-traumatizing, re-victimizing, and then not taking into account that these are people who are going to make decisions in their lives, whose lives may be connected after this criminal justice contact. And so why don't we set them up with the tools to break some of these habits and engage in healthier practices? Because one thing that experts will tell you is that those who harm or those who engage in intimate partner violence don't necessarily want to hurt other people. And I look back at my own experiences too, and it's something that I freely and openly talk to DAs about as well. And it's this idea that the way that we function in relationships really is a product of the things that we experience, the things that have been modeled for us, the things that we internalize. I myself have struggled in intimate partnerships and had some less than healthy practices because of the trauma that I have been exposed to, because of what the trauma that my parents were exposed to and how that affect the ways that they formed and maintained relationships. And so if you had told me, hey, you should know better, you should do this in a relationship, there's a period of time where I would have to tell you I wasn't capable of that. But because I have had access to therapy spaces, for example, I've been able to have reparative experiences. I've been able to put tools in my toolbox to function in healthier manners. And those are the things that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's really powerful. So you're following in the footsteps of, you know, a handful of leftists who are trying their hand at doing this, at putting on the prosecutor hat and hopefully reforming in a real tangible way that their office does business. Have you garnered some lessons from seeing, you know, sort of other progressive DAs around the country? And what are some things that have inspired you? What are some things that you probably don't intend to follow?
So there certainly is a lot to be built on and learned from. You know, one example that I immediately think of is, you know, overwhelmingly, Larry Krasner has done some incredible work. There are certainly things that he has done that are worthy of criticism. But one thing that I look to is the fact that when he got into office, a few months went by before he realized that a portion of his line assistant district attorneys weren't following the policy mm-hmm. directives. And so how do we make sure that that doesn't happen? For me, one of the things that I've been thinking about is the fact that we have this great organization in New York City called Court Watch, where folks in real time are keeping the data, are letting folks know what's happening in arraignments. I couldn't ask for better eyes and ears, right? To know immediately whether the ADAs that are on the ground doing the work are actually following the directives, then inviting Court Watch and saying, please hold me and mine accountable. And so that's an area where I would do things a little bit differently. One of the other things I think about is I imagine that I will have missteps, that I will not always get it right. And the idea of having full transparency and accountability is a way where I hope to encourage the community to really push back and let me know when they are displeased with me and have those conversations. I am doing this because, again, I just feel such an intimate connection to the health and success of my neighbors, my community. If I mess up, I want to be called out on it. I want to be reminded to do better.
Right. Like, we all mess things up all of the time, and sort of creating those feedback mechanisms for transparency and accountability. I mean, I think Larry Krasner's done a really good job and has modeled some really amazing things, you know, in his, you know, the memos that his office has put out about, you know, which crimes they're going to focus on and which ones they aren't, and how to calculate the cost of incarceration as sort of a thing to consider in when you're making decisions of whether to prosecute or not are really important. At the same time, you know, sort of Current Affairs put out an article about his prosecution of, or his appeal of the in the Mumia case.
Current Affairs, written by Oren Nimni.
Written by me. But I think that the sort of one of the core point of that piece was what you're getting at, which is not necessarily like I think I take issue with the substance of the particular decision. But beyond that, I think the thing that was a little bit more disheartening for me was the sort of, well, you guys should trust me. I know as the DA that I'm going to make the right decision, you know, sort of wait and see. And that it didn't seem like there was as much of a mechanism of transparency and accountability where it could be right, because I'm open to the possibility that he has made a really, really considered judgment and thinks this is the best thing because of the impact it might have on other criminal defendants or, you know, whatever his reasoning is, but that there needs to be that kind of back and forth. And it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, actually opening up that mechanism for accountability is core.
The community should know. And quite frankly, I'm sitting from a place of saying, I trust you, my community, because you know. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also an opportunity to, when you really, again, fully pull back that curtain to say, I did this thing. It's not having the intended impact. We're ready to make changes to get to that point. And by the way, look at the system for all it's worth, because it might be a situation where the constraints of the system are such that it's not allowing me to be successful in this way. And so here, community is an opportunity for us to get together, have these conversations, lobby for some things so that I can do these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a great place for like public education too. I think one thing that we've seen AOC, for example, do is, rather than say like, oh, I'm constrained, say like, oh, I'm constrained and let me show you what the constraints are. Like, I will tell you exactly what the constraints are.
Yeah, and that's been so well received. It's incredible how much we don't know.
But it's pretty intentional as well. So, you know,
very much so. Trying to change that. You were sort of talking a little bit about like what Krasner's line DAs were doing. And here in Boston, Rachel Rollins, the Suffolk DA, also put out a list of crimes she wasn't going to prosecute. And that hasn't so far panned out. Those crimes are still being prosecuted, and there's a little bit of a question of why that's happening, whether it's just changes aren't being made quickly enough or whether it's line DAs or ADAs. And I guess the question is, part of it is new policy, but part of it is there's just a culture in district attorney's offices that is partially created by the incentives, like you were talking about, in the metrics of success of, you know, like, you know, how many cases have you closed and won, like how many people have you put away. But how do you think that you're going to go about changing that less tangible culture?
You mean the practical steps for it, like the actual implementation?
Yeah, just like beyond sort of saying like, look, you know, our metric isn't necessarily how many people you put away. Like, how do you change the mindset of someone that's like, well, I actually became a DA to do this thing, or in a less malicious way, like, I became a DA because I think that protecting my community looks like this, and what you're telling me is that protecting my community doesn't look like this.
Yeah. So there are so many components to this. And again, it's prioritizing DAs having intimate knowledge of communities. And again, having intimate knowledge around trauma and trauma-informed practices. But the other thing is, to your point, DAs come in wanting to do a certain kind of job. And it I think really is one where they hope to help people, to keep people safe, to maybe change the system from the inside. And then you get there and you find out that the constraints of the system are such that you don't get to have the impact that you thought you were going to have. And so this is an opportunity to actually have that kind of an impact, because you won't have your higher ups really dictating a culture that is antithetical to true safety, true justice. And so it's about making targeted changes in the folks that really dictate the culture and how we implement justice. One example that I like to give is that when I'm in arraignments picking up new cases, I could pick up two identical cases And one could say, hey, ADA so-and-so from Trial Bureau 50, and one can say ADA so-and-so from Trial Bureau 30. And I know that those two cases are going to be handled entirely differently, that the outcomes are going to be wildly different. And it's not because of the assigned ADA. It's because of the trial bureau chief in those trial bureaus who supervises, you know, 100 ADAs or whatever it is. And so understanding that if you have somebody in that position who gets the mission, who is on board, then really they set the tone. And the folks, the ones that are newer to their careers, younger in their practice, they get on board. And it's these are the things, again, it sort of translates to everything. These are the things that you learn that are your foundation, that you internalize, that become very ingrained in your practice.
I wonder if it might be important for or useful if Tiffany gave a little bit of context. You know, like I think it might be worth mentioning, for example, that Queen's current DA has been in office for almost 30 years, and you know, some of the policy and cultural implications of that tenure. Tiffany, does that make sense for you to add?
Yeah, there really hasn't been change in that office for decades. And it's because there hasn't been a challenge for it. Again, there's been no accountability and transparency. Nobody knows what's being done in the office. The data isn't being kept and released to folks. And we have a DA that has been in office since 91, 92, who was
Will you remind us for our listeners who that DA is?
Richard Brown. So he came into office in 1991 or 92, I believe, and he wasn't even voted in by the people of Queens. He was appointed and hasn't been opposed in all of those years. There really has not been any incentive for Richard Brown and the office to change with the times, while everybody else is recognizing that the war on drugs doesn't work, that, you know, all of the different things that we've talked about are the direction that we should be moving. There has been zero reason for our DA to take those things into consideration. The fact that Richard Brown says, hey, we don't consider immigration as a collateral consequence in the world's borough, in the borough in Queens that has the highest population of immigrant communities.
In 2019, it's really unthinkable.
That's just baffling. My eyebrows are disappearing into my hair.
Tiffany, it's been such a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we wish you luck. But before we wrap up, please tell our listeners where they can find more information about your platform, where they can get updates on your race, and where they can follow you on social media.
Yes, absolutely. So please check us out at the website. It's www.gabanforqueens.com. So that's CABANFORQUEENS.com. Same Instagram and Twitter handle, so you can catch me there. And the election, June 25th.
Great.
All right, listeners, June 25th.
Well, thank you again, Birdfeed. It's been nice hanging out with you. Stay tuned for more legal episodes. This episode was edited by Dan Thorne at Pink Noise Studios in Somerville, Massachusetts. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.